Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of the really fun things about doing this show is that publishers send me some really cool books. Sometimes they fit into the scope and flavor of our show, sometimes not. When Elsa Richardson's new book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut, showed up in my mailbox, I wasn't quite sure, but after reading a few chapters, I knew we wanted to talk to this amazing author. Elsa Richardson is an academic at the University of Strathclyde, Glasgow, where she holds a Chancellor's Fellowship in the History of Health and Medicine. Her knowledge is vast and her communication skills are impressive and on full display in Rumbles, which is a fascinating journey through the history of science and culture as it pertains to our digestive system and the ways it affects how we think and feel. She joins us now from her home in Glasgow, Scotland. Elsa Richardson, welcome to Blue Dot.
Dave, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, this is a really interesting read for me. And I will confess something that I like to read when I'm in the WC.
Oh, really? As many people do it.
But I found this one was like, do I really want to read this now? So it was like, I decided to read it when I was doing other things. But I really enjoyed it. It was really fascinating. So my first question for you is, what made you decide that you wanted to write a book about the social history and the cultural history and the story of the gut?
There's a number of answers to that. So one, I'm a historian of health and medicine by training, but I'm kind of tend to be more interested in, I guess, what we might describe as kind of everyday histories of health. So the way that everyday folks have thought about their bodies and have tried to intervene in their health. And from there, I think what kind of struck me, especially when I was looking at, which is my area of specialism, the 19th and early part of the 20th century, I was really interested in how often the question of digestion, and especially anxieties around bad digestion, dyspepsia, constipation, and so on, seemed to really be at the crux of how normal, non-experts, regular people approached their health. So that was, kind of one aspect of it. And another, to be honest, another driver was just how much my friends, my family, my colleagues sometimes seem to be kind of increasingly keen to talk about their digestive well-being or lack of. And I think it was those kind of two drivers. So looking at this, the history, but also being aware that digestion and the gut seem to be a kind of growing modern day concern.
Yeah. And I would suppose a lot of that has to do with just, there's a lot of factors, and we'll talk about these in a bit, but so much of it is just our lives are so busy and stressed out that we tend to, eat a lot of stuff on the run. And, the days that where you used to just, people normally would sit down, have a meal, take their time. It seems like people don't get to do that as much anymore. And I bet that has something to do with it.
I think that certainly has something to do with it. But part of what also fascinated me about looking into the history of the gut was how that anxiety about not eating right, about eating on the go, about not having enough time to kind of digest properly and treat your gut well, how that set of kind of cluster of anxieties and worries really has a much longer history. So I think we tend to look at our present moment and think, as you just articulated, in the past, people had time to sit down and eat properly. What I found in my research was that actually since at least the 18th century, this anxiety, this kind of coupling of, a perception around the kind of growing speed of modern life and a feeling that the gut somehow can't keep up with that speed. That is observable from the 18th century onwards. So what feels, pertinent and new to us actually, I think, has been with us a lot longer.
Yeah. Define what is the gut to you, and how do you define that in terms of your book?
Well, it's a bit of a kind of, it's a little amorphous in a way. I think the gut can refer to a set of organs and parts within the body, a system within the body. So it can refer to our digestive system, which encapsulates, as I'm sure you know, much more than our bellies, right? There's many other parts linked to that. Also, you could, you know, if you really wanted to go into it, you could incorporate things like, you know, the enteric nervous system, for example, that governs digestion, absorption, all of that business too. The gut also refers to, you know, could just refer to your belly, right? I don't know whether this is true of North Americans, but certainly in Britain, we refer to the gut as being, you know, or having a gut as being perhaps having a bit of a kind of softer, a bit of a soft stomach. You know, the opposite of a six pack, I guess is what I'm saying. But I think the gut has this, and what really fascinates me is the kind of rich and lively cultural life that this gut, this part of the body, seems to have. And in the book, I guess like part of what I'm kind of attempting to do is to kind of think about this connection between the gut as a, you know, a very real part of the body, right? Something that exists within the body that has a kind of fleshy reality and materiality, but also to think about the gut as something which has a kind of metaphoric and cultural power, which is linked to its fleshy materiality, but which is also in some ways distinct.
You being a historian about health, that's what I really enjoyed about this, because you dive into all kinds of interesting stories going all the way back to, you know, ancient times. So maybe pick out what was some of the most interesting things that you discovered, you know, going back to the classical times of Rome and Greece, and because they were pretty obsessed with the gut and digestion back then too.
Absolutely obsessed. You know, I think one of the most interesting things that I discovered was, I think that to come back to the kind of, you know, the beginning of our conversation, I think that one of the reasons that we're so obsessed with our guts at the moment is that there is such a wealth of, you know, incredibly interesting scientific research coming out at the moment, which is, you know, really expanding our appreciation of the gut, but specifically of the connection between the gut and the brain. So this kind of gut-brain axis, this gut-brain connection, I think is part of what's kind of sparking our modern-day interest, or modern-day kind of preoccupation with digestion. And scientists, as they are wont to do, present this as being kind of groundbreaking, right? That, you know, that we are just uncovering this link between the stomach and the mind. And what I found out in my research is that as long as we have thought about, written about, and investigated the gut, one of our kind of key interests has been with its connection to the mind. So this, you know, this imaginary, you know, relationship, this imagined relationship, rather, is one which is, you know, actually absolutely stretches back to ancient Greece and to ancient Rome. And I think that part of what I found so interesting about looking at these older materials was that it seemed to me that ancient physicians, so I looked particularly at Galen, were much more comfortable than we are today, actually, with the idea that intelligence might not just reside in the brain, right? That intelligence could be something which is more diffuse, is dispersed around the body in different ways. So Galen, for example, had this conviction that the stomach was another thinking organ. So he absolutely thought that, you know, the brain was the kind of chief thinking organ, right? That, you know, did most of the kind of, you know, rationalizing and, you know, the big thinking. But he made space for other organs to have kind of the capacity for a distinct kind of intelligence. And he argued that the stomach in particular was an intelligent organ. And he made the case for this on the basis that the stomach could register its own emptiness. I love that phrase, to register its own emptiness. And because of this, he said that, you know, that the stomach really was capable of thinking apart from the brain, right? Had its own kind of, was it like a kind of autonomous region, an autonomous thinking region in the body. So part of what fascinates me is just like, I think that when you kind of step away from the modern period, what seems to emerge is an understanding of the body, which is often less tied to, you know, I think our kind of quite modern conception of the brain as being really the most kind of important organ in the body, or the kind of, you know, the most essential bit of us.
Well, and one of the interesting things I took away from your book too, is there's been this kind of constant push and pull about, well, you know, the higher functioning the brain is where, you know, the higher level human is. And then, you know, the gut is where some of your more base instincts come from. And, you know, this kind of, you know, that dichotomy, I found that interesting. Mm.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, back to keep with the ancient world, you know, to look at a philosopher like Plato, for example. So Plato is, yeah, he was just really not a fan of the gut at all, actually. And so Plato has this conception of the emotions as being kind of linked to particular bodily parts. So our emotional lives for him are, or, you know, what he would probably describe as the passions rather than the emotions, but our passions are produced by, affiliated with, and kind of governed by certain organs in the body. So obviously, you know, the head is where, you know, most of our best passions, you know, our kind of most moral feelings arise, sit. And then down on through the body, you know, so you have the heart, which is associated with courage, but also maybe more problematically with anger, and then down to the guts. And for Plato, you know, the guts really are the site where your kind of basest passions arise. So anything, you know, avarice, lust, all of those, gluttony, right? Like all of those kind of, you know, the worst aspects of ourselves for him arise and, you know, sit and are located in deep in the viscera and in the intestines. And he then charges the kind of upper parts of the body, so the head and even the heart, with kind of keeping them, keeping those base instincts in check. And I think that, you know, that it's possible to trace a line from someone like Plato through to the present day. I think that we still have a kind of bit of a mistrust around the gut, you know, and maybe that sometimes is expressed in our anxieties about digestion, but also I think we can see it in kind of theories around leaky gut syndrome. I don't know if you've ever come across this idea of the leaky gut.
No, not really.
No. So leaky gut syndrome is this idea which is has some kind of purchase, I guess, in wellness circles, and I guess is a kind of appealing theory, especially for those people who are suffering from a variety of kind of, you know, quite mysterious and difficult to treat gastric conditions. So I'm thinking here of things like Crohn's, of like irritable bowel syndrome. And the theory of the leaky gut is that basically, you know, materials sitting too long in the bowel will putrefy and then begin leaking toxins through the walls of the bowel out into the rest of the body, causing all kinds of like terrible inflammation. And that it's that kind of the inflammatory work of all of that, those kind of like bad bacteria coming back into the system, which cause, you know, irritable bowel syndrome or Crohn's or whatever. And I guess, you know, without getting into the weeds about whether that is, you know, the kind of scientific literature around that, which is fairly skeptical of this theory, I think that part of what it speaks to is this similar mistrust of the gut and this suspicion or this kind of way of thinking about the gut as a kind of storehouse of filth in the body, that there's something grubby about the gut. And I think that we can kind of trace a kind of through line from Plato to some of our kind of modern suspicions about what the gut is.
Yeah, now that's very interesting. And one of the other things I really enjoyed reading this, and it kind of, it would always put a smile on my face, was all of the sayings that we've had through the years, you know, trust your gut. I have a gut feeling about this. Just so many of those sayings through time. And even, you know, going back to, like, I remember in the 50s and 60s, there was the expression, oh, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, you know, advice to women, you know, to make sure you hang on to your man or whatever. And you weave a lot of those through the story. And it's like, I'd never really thought about it before I read this, but it's really interesting to think about how many times we refer to someone, if they have courage, they got guts.
Absolutely. I guess that was kind of part of the one of the points of the book, in a way, was to say that a lot of the way that we currently think about our guts is kind of governed by the biosciences, right? Is kind of governed by medical thinking around the gut, all of which is super interesting and absolutely has its place. But I guess part of what I was interested in doing with the book was saying, look, actually, like, the gut kind of exists in language, right? And the gut very much exists in culture. So I think if we're going to get to a better understanding of what the gut means to us, we need to really examine, you know, all of the ways that it lives in culture. And one of those ways certainly is through language. You know, I looked at English sayings. There are also sayings from, like, around the world. You know, this is quite kind of culturally universal. The gut seems to have this, like a lively linguistic or colloquial presence in our lives, which I think is maybe kind of just as important as biomedical descriptions and ways of accounting for it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, it's so often associated with courage. You know, it's like, that person's gutless. Like, well, nobody's gutless, but, you know, I'm not sure what the gut has to do with courage. Although, when you think about it, when you're scared, your tummy can get upset.
Yes, I think this association between guts and courage is really, really an interesting one. And so I came across this account of intestinal fortitude, which is maybe I don't know if it's a phrase that we use quite so often now, but apparently it was very popular around World War I. And it was coined by a professor of clinical medicine, actually, at Ohio State University, called John W. Wills. And he describes in his memoir how, you know, he was traveling back to his office after coaching the college football team. And, you know, he's thinking about the class that he has to teach, and he's thinking about the sports that he's just been instructing. And these kind of mingle with his thoughts on physiology and brings this new expression, right, intestinal fortitude, to mind. And he basically gives this kind of, you know, barnstorming lecture to the kind of young men gathered at Ohio State University in his class about this idea that, you know, true kind of masculine courage is a matter of visceral physiology, right? That, like, somehow more than just metaphorically, the gut has some kind of role to play in, you know, the courageousness, right? This idea of kind of intestinal fortitude. And, you know, I think the part of what's so poignant about this, one, I think it's interesting the way that this for him is, you know, it's quite gendered, right? He's been coaching the football team. Then he's about to give a lecture to an all-male class of physiology students. And it's in that moment that he decides to talk about this new idea of intestinal fortitude. And it's also quite moving because I think, you know, he's speaking rather on the eve of the First World War, right? So he's speaking to these students in 1914. And what he doesn't know, but what we know, is that many of these students will then end up going to Europe to fight in World War I, or going to elsewhere in the world to fight in this war, where this intestinal fortitude is going to be, you know, tested in the most extreme and kind of, you know, undoing way. And I guess, yeah, it just struck me as being interesting as a kind of, very gendered expression of the way that the way that the gut functions in culture.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Elsa Richardson, author of the new book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with Elsa Richardson, expert on the history of medicine from the University of Strathclyde, Glasgow, and author of the new book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut.
Part of why I think the gut exists, or part of why the gut has such a lively life for us in culture, is because for so long, it has been so difficult to really comprehend what on earth is going on in there. So part of the problem for a long time, you know, for medical thinkers and experimenters, for a large period of history, was that, you know, the gut is one, it's buried really deep in the body. Okay. So it's really deep in the viscera. So it's kind of hard to get to. Two, it also doesn't really make sense, or the stomach particularly doesn't really make sense when it is removed from the body. So, you know, if you're doing kind of dissection, an organ like the heart, you can dissect the heart, you can observe its valves, and you can get a sense of, you know, what the heart does when it's in a living body. The stomach is kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's a pump. Right. It's pretty simple, really.
Yes, it's a pump, and you can examine the kind of, you know, the structures of that and get to grips with what it would do in a living body. The stomach is a much more difficult proposition. So, you know, for example, in the very early manuals instructing on, you know, how to conduct dissections, so how, you know, books of anatomy, anatomists, medical students were instructed to get to the stomach first. Okay, so you open up the body, you open up the cadaver, and the first thing you have to get to is the belly, right? You've got to get in there. And part of the reason for that is it decays much quicker than the rest of the body. So it's really, you know, it's a kind of ticking time bomb in the stomach. But even if you do get to it quickly, when it comes out of the body, it kind of doesn't make that much sense, right? There's certain things you can observe about it. The intricate kind of nerves on the, you know, the lining of the stomach, for example. But unless you see it in motion, its function is, you know, hard to parse, right? It's hard to kind of understand. So that is why I think, anyway, there's such part of why there's such a kind of cultural, a rich cultural life around the stomach, and a rich metaphorical life for the stomach and the gut in culture. Because I think for so long it was so kind of, you know, we needed metaphorical language, you know, we needed language to fill the gap in medical understanding. In a way.
Yeah, there's an interesting diagram that you have from Edward Jenner of this like strange, like looks like coral fans. Mm. And I looked at that and I just thought to myself, what the heck is that? And, you know, what is that thing?
So Edward Jenner, it's a really kind of weirdly beautiful image, I think, until you kind of understand what it is. It's a kind of fanned out, the fanned out lining of a stomach. So it's kind of, you know, it's hard to describe on radio, but it looks like a kind of lady's hand fan. But when you look up close, you can see that what he's done is made a kind of specimen from a stomach lining. And you can see there the kind of really like intricate and delicate system of nerves around the stomach. And it's very eerily beautiful, but also gruesome in some ways. But, you know, like, I guess that's kind of my point, right? Is that, like, for a lot of medical history, that was the best we could do, right? You know, Edward Jenner's beautiful preparation of this dissected stomach, which could tell us a lot about the intricate patterns of those nerves, but couldn't really get us any closer to understanding exactly what was going on in the stomach of a living person. So just to fill you in on another kind of gruesome medical story. So another breakthrough took place in the early 19th century. So in 1822 in Michigan, actually. And basically what happens is there is a kind of American fur trading company up there, and there's a shop, a large store, and it's a kind of busy day in the store. People are trading furs, you know, whatever else, goods. And an unfortunate man, Alexis St. Martin, is shot in the stomach. So a gun goes off by accident. It's, you know, it's a complete kind of fluke. He's shot in the stomach, and it looks like it's kind of lights out for him. A local doctor is called, William Beaumont, and he comes and he takes Alexis St. Martin back to his house. And somehow St. Martin kind of manages to make it through the night. He makes it through the next day. And actually, he's kind of recovering pretty well, apart from the fact that he has a giant gaping hole into his stomach. So like a kind of window into the stomach, basically a kind of fleshy fistula starts to form. So there's this kind of like, yeah, like a kind of a view onto the gut. William Bowman sees this, you know, I think many other doctors, I would hope, would sew up the fistula and send their patient on their way.
Yeah, but not this guy. This is quite the story. Go ahead.
Yeah, not William. Instead, he sees an opportunity. And basically what he sees is this opportunity to better understand what is going on in this mysterious organ. And he's very interested in the role of acids or gastric juices in digesting food. Now, in this early part of the 19th century, that is still very much up for debate. Okay, people don't know, or doctors debate whether or not it's an acid or whether it's the motion of the stomach that digests food. Okay, it's still quite mysterious. So he sees an opportunity to really kind of get to the bottom of this. And what he does is he starts attaching little pieces of food. So a little bit of chicken, a bit of apple. I think at one point he tries cake, and he attaches them onto little pieces of string. And then he dangles them through the fistula, so through the open wound in St. Martin's stomach, and into his gut. And he leaves them there for a time. Then he takes them out and observes how digested they've become. He then, at one point, which is, yeah, maybe like quite gruesome, he licks the fistula to taste whether it's acidic or not, right? Is this, mm-hmm. is there stomach acid here? And from all of this research, you know, he produces, you know, really some quite groundbreaking work in terms of understanding the role of gastric juices in digestion, right? So we finally get this kind of window, this much desired window onto the kind of mysteries of what's going on in the belly. I think the kind of the downside of this really is that he acts in an incredibly unethical way. So he essentially keeps Alexis St. Martin almost kind of prisoner, almost like a kind of indentured labor for him.
Like a medical slave.
Like a medical slave, exactly. He promises again and again that he will sew up the wound and that he will give him his, you know, passage back to Canada. I think he's French-Canadian. He's from Quebec. And he, you know, again and again is, you know, put off. He makes promises that he doesn't keep. And eventually Alexis St. Martin has to make a run for it. So he kind of, you know, absconds and runs back to his family in Canada. And then his family in Canada later on down the line are so worried that when Alexis St. Martin dies, that William Bowman will try and get a hold of his body to display as part of his kind of as part of the lecture series that's come out of the book that he's published about his experiments with Alexis St. Martin, that his family basically allow his body to kind of putrefy and decay to quite a kind of substantial degree before they bury him. So they basically make sure that he is useless to, you know, to Bowman before they are willing to kind of bury him. So yeah, a grim story.
Let's switch back to the brain stomach or brain gut connection. One of the interesting things to me, and it was kind of an aha moment from my childhood. There was a TV show I used to watch as a little kid called Gomer Pyle, USMC. Mm-hmm. He was a Marine, and Gomer was just a really nice guy. And he started eating this dish that gave him really weird dreams and made him sleepwalk and do things completely out of character. And he kept talking about eating Welsh rarebit. And I had no idea as a child what Welsh rarebit was. Is it a rabbit? What the heck is that? I'd never heard of that in my life or seen it. And it wasn't until I read your book that it was like, oh, that's what that TV show was talking about. So tell us about dreaming and the gut and Welsh rarebit.
Well, I love that you I love that you know, this is very interesting to me that you don't know what Welsh rarebit is, because I just assumed from this cartoon strip, The Dream of the Rarebit Fiend, which was a wildly, wildly popular cartoon strip run in newspapers in New York in the kind of, I guess it's like the 1920s, 1930s, by this cartoonist Windsor McKay. I just assumed that it was a dish wildly and widely enjoyed in North America, but I'm not, this is untrue, apparently.
Well, I had never encountered it in my life. You know, nobody had ever served it to me, or I didn't know. I literally had no idea what they were talking about. But explain, what is it?
I can give you the recipe afterwards. Anyway, so basically, Windsor McKay's Dream of the Rarebit Fiend was this cartoon strip in which its kind of main protagonist would, after a kind of day of working too many hours, you know, going out drinking, etc., would finish his evening with a dish of Welsh rarebit. So Welsh rarebit, for those of you who don't know, is a kind of like, it's like kind of like jazzed up cheese on toast. It's like a jazzed up kind of grilled cheese. It has like, yeah, it's cheesy, it's bread, it's a lot of cheese, there's bread there. But yeah, the main component definitely is excessive amounts of cheese. And in the cartoon strip, it would show the dreams. So it would kind of illustrate the dreams that the protagonist would have after kind of indulging in this late night cheesy snack. And there were always kind of, you know, like wild escapades across the kind of New York City skyline where, you know, the, you know, his bed would levitate and float out the window, or he would, like, I don't know, encounter kind of elephants on Fifth Avenue and so on and so forth. And part of what I found really interesting about this was, I think that it's an expression of one, I think, a quite like particular understanding of cheese as something which is kind of capable of giving you weird dreams or nightmares, but also kind of more generally this linkage, which has really been present and persistent since the Middle Ages, between the stomach and the dreaming mind. So for a doctor in the medieval period, the idea would be that, you know, the food that you eat sitting in your stomach produces vapors, and those vapors rise up through the body into the brain, into the mind, and produce nightmares there. So, you know, in the Middle Ages, for example, they were very interested in dreams, right? Dreams had, I think, more importance and more significance than we perhaps now accord them. And you would have people, dedicated dream doctors, who would be responsible for, you know, interpreting dreams, or, you know, offering kind of readings of your dreams. And for them, what I found really interesting was that they, dreams that occurred in the morning were seen as being of a kind of purer, more spiritual nature than dreams that occurred in the, you know, when you just went to bed. And the thinking there was that in the morning, your stomach is empty. So if you've done the kind of digesting of the day, the digesting of the night rather, and therefore your mind is more open to spiritual interventions, to kind of, you know, godly visions, than when you just go to bed and you're still digesting and your dreams are being kind of produced by the kind of digesting putrid matter in your stomach.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating because, you know, we all have weird dreams and we always wonder, well, what brought that on? And one of the things you first usually do is like, well, what did I eat last night?
Yes, yeah. There was a really wonderful and kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek survey done by the British Cheese Board. Do you get it? British Cheese Board. which surveyed people's experiences of eating particular cheeses and the kind of dreams that they had after those cheeses. So they found that there seemed to be some kind of differentiation between different kinds of cheese and different kinds of dreams. So, you know, people who ate, I don't know, Red Leicester were more likely to have bizarre dreams. People who ate Gorgonzola were more likely to dream of celebrities and so on. But what they also found, or what other studies rather have found, is that it's kind of quite culturally specific. So I, as a British person, really believe in my heart of hearts that cheese gives me strange dreams. However, if you go to Southern European nations, France, Italy, Spain, there is no such correlation. So people don't in any way recognize a kind of link between eating cheese and having strange dreams, even though obviously those are, you know, fairly enthusiastic cheese eating nations, which also suggests to me that there may be some, there are some cultural influences in how we dream also.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Elsa Richardson, author of the new book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with author Elsa Richardson. Her new book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut, is a fascinating journey through time and our evolving understanding of the mysteries of digestion. There's also kind of this push and pull through your book about diet and nutrition. The idea that, you know, eating meat, you know, is bad, and especially red meat. And we kind of know that from modern medicine and nutrition tells us it really limit the red meat you eat, and vegetarianism. And it was really interesting to read about a very famous name in America, Mr. Kellogg.
Love the Kelloggs. Very interesting. So the Kelloggs come up, especially in the history of diet and especially in the history of vegetarianism, which I think in relation to the gut is particularly interesting, because I think one of the kind of through lines that I'm tracing through the book certainly is around diet. And my interest has been with the way that diet has been used to not only kind of nourish the gut, let's say, or kind of feed the gut, or, you know, better manage the gut, but control the gut. So what I found interesting is how so often the language of dietary advice through history has been, at least in part, directed at this idea that the gut is somehow a kind of unmanageable and unruly force in the body, and that only through the moderation of one's diet is it possible to kind of control this unruly force. So, you know, we're back to Plato and the idea of the stomach as a kind of site of base passions. I think it's possible to look at the Kelloggs and the, you know, the diet that they prescribed, cornflakes, soy milk, loved soy milk, no meat, no alcohol, no stimulants, as a way to, again, try and police the kind of unruliness of the gut. So, you know, I think that one of the things that everybody knows about Harvey Kellogg was that he was, you know, really concerned about the detrimental effects that masturbation had, and really worried that, excessive or not even that excessive, was really damaging to both your emotional and your physical health. And one of the ways that he suggests that it is possible to avoid giving in to that temptation is
to curb your enthusiasm.
Yeah, to curb your enthusiasm, exactly. To, you know, better govern oneself is through what do they say in Seinfeld? Master of your domain.
Yes, yes.
Master of your domain.
Master of your own domain.
That's it, exactly. Is through diet, right? So, eating a kind of, for him to eat a kind of high fiber, low stimulant diet with certainly no red meat was a way that you were able to kind of police that, you know, dangerous urge. So I think part of what that reveals is the way that, like, diet has often been not only about, you know, health, has not only been about weight loss, let's say, but has also been directed at, unruly or unsociable, sinful instincts.
Yeah, it ties back to those ancient ideas that those base instincts come from deep within. Yeah. Exactly. So eat cornflakes and don't think naughty thoughts and you'll be healthier.
Yeah, just eat your cornflakes.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk a bit about some, you know, interesting modern ideas and how modern really are they, as you keep pointing out. The move to probiotics and the fascination now with the microbiome, because, you know, we have so many interesting flora in our guts, and we're really learning more about that. In fact, we were talking about dogs earlier, and I've noticed I give my little aging dog Pearl, I give her probiotic capsules with her dinner, and I have noticed, you know, it's anecdotal, I suppose, but I have noticed an improvement in her health and appetite, and I'm wondering if those things are helping, you know, since it is or seems to be, I keep giving them to her.
Yes. Oh, that's so lovely. I mean, I thought you were going to say, you know, which is one thing I think about with my dog all the time, is this, you know, incredible research that's coming out about our gut microbiome, which shows that if you are a dog owner, you share something, I mean, I don't have the exact figure, but something crazy, like 30% of your gut microbiome is the same as your dog's microbiome.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that remarkable?
That is amazing. So
the same little kind of, you know, tiny creatures, the same kind of, you know, little ecosystem that you have in your belly shares a lot in common with your dogs, which I think is just, you know, is for someone who, you know, loves animals and is interested in all of those kind of, like, you know, cross species connections. I think there's something really beautiful about the idea that within us we have other creatures.
And there's also something that I was kind of unaware of until very recently. I heard a story on Science Friday here on NPR about crapsules, where people actually consume the stuff from people. I don't know how to put it, but they're putting, you know, their husband's poop in a capsule and eating it so that they can have the same microbiome going on in their gut. That seems strange to me.
So I think that crapsules is a lovely way of putting it. Fecal transplants is another way that they're described. Yeah, so these are really interesting. It does seem from studies that have been undertaken, although they haven't been, you know, there's not been large scale yet, that there does seem to be some improvement in people's health from these kind of fecal transplants. So the idea basically is that, you know, if you have a condition, for example, like IBS or like Crohn's, or even if you've just been on, you know, had some really heavy, heavy duty antibiotics over a long period of time, this will have kind of flushed out much of the kind of good bacteria in your stomach. So, you know, if you think of your kind of microbiome as being an ecosystem, you may have a quite depleted ecosystem. And the idea with the kind of the fecal transplants is that, you know, by taking in, literally other people's matter, other people's bacteria, you can help start to repopulate your own, depleted ecosystem. And there does seem to be, like, you know, pretty remarkable evidence that they are effective.
I'll just stick with the probiotic capsules, thank you.
I mean, obviously, you have to choose the right poo, right? You know, you don't.
Well, that's one of the things that this professor from UCLA pointed out. I forget her name, but she said, you know, you also could be picking up things that you don't want to have in your microbiome. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah,
too.
Absolutely. And also, there's also, which I think is another sticking point here, which is the question. I was speaking to a microbiologist the other day, who said, you know, who was really challenging this idea of bad and good bacteria, right? Mm-hmm. And that part of what that she was suggesting was, like, listen, actually, this is, like, that is something that we're putting, you know, this is a kind of projection and kind of a stupid way of understanding, actually, our gut flora. Rather, she was suggesting that, or rather, she was asserting that, you know, any microorganism in our gut can be good or bad. They're not innately good or bad for us. Rather, it normally depends on the individual makeup of your belly, of your body, you know, of your person, that comes to dictate whether that particular microbe is a good microbe or a bad microbe.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's the question of individuality there, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite a fascinating field of study, and so much we don't really know about how those microbes, you know, operate and how they make us feel, and definitely the hazards of eating foods or anything that's been treated with antibiotics.
It's super mysterious. And I think that any scientist working on the microbiome seriously today would say that there is still mostly we don't know yet. You know, there is a kind of, I think, a site in the body, but also a site in popular culture that has like a lot of promise, right? I feel like anytime you buy, I don't know, like a fermented food, like some cabbage or whatever, there are big promises normally being made by the package, the cabbage package, you know, about kind of, you know, improving your gut microbiome and, you know, and in doing so, making you like, you know, live longer, healthier and happier and so on. But none of these claims are like quite supported by the science yet. I think that most kind of, you know, diligent scientists would say that we have a lot more to learn about the microbiome.
Well, maybe I'll just have yogurt and cornflakes and hope for the best.
Master of your own domain, yogurt, cornflakes, you'll be fine.
Okay. I was also fascinated to read your chapter called Eating at the Desk. About, you know, lunch, because it's just, you know, something I never really think about, but, you know, how lunch is so integrated into our modern industrial lifestyles.
Yeah, I think, you know, I make the rather grandiose and large claim in the book that lunch is essentially an invention of the Victorians. And the reason that I do this is partly because up until industrialization and urbanization in the 19th century, lunch is like not really a thing. So, you know, you eat kind of large meal in the morning, then you might go out to work, and then you would probably come back for kind of early dinner. And this kind of, maybe you might have a snack, you know, a little snack in the middle of the day, but there's no kind of like dedicated lunching hour, let's say, or no dedicated lunch meal that we call lunch. And part of the reason that it emerges and part of the reason that we begin to need lunch is because of the kind of expansion of the working day, so longer hours, but also that people are now commuting into work, right? So you don't necessarily live right next to where you work anymore. You might have to travel in, and therefore you're unable to travel back to eat a kind of early evening meal, let's say. And what I find really fascinating is that, you know, just as like this new meal emerges into the world, it carries with it a lot of the same anxieties that I think that we today have around lunch and the midday meal. So this kind of, you know, this idea that there's something, which I guess is where we kind of began our conversation, that there's something kind of a little bit dangerous about our habits of eating on the go, of eating in a way that kind of lacks attention, right? So today we would think about it as, you know, chomping a kind of sandwich while you're checking your emails. In the 19th century, desk workers were advised against eating, you know, the practice of eating kind of dry crackers while at their ledger books. And the idea being that, you know, there is, I don't know, almost like a kind of like competition between the brain and the belly, right? And that if you are doing something that involves brain work at the same time as you're eating, you are kind of taking away digestive power from the stomach and also thinking power from the brain, right? So this basically this idea that, you know, the body can't kind of multitask in this way. And I think that we still kind of live with that, like, kind of slight anxiety around the working lunch.
We're about out of time, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about rumbles. The actual sounds that our tummies make, is it bad when you have an overly noisy gut?
Not necessarily at all. In fact, noisy guts are kind of really important. Recently, I was speaking with someone at a book fair. And what's really wonderful about it is when you write this kind of book, people come up and tell you all kinds of horrible medical stories. And this lovely chap shared a particularly horrible medical story with me, which he had recently gone in for very kind of very serious surgery on his intestines. Basically, what had happened was that his intestines had become kind of coiled the wrong way. So they had become kind of tangled in his body. And that this was causing him all sorts of terrible, terrible digestive discomfort, as you can probably well imagine. And I said, well, you know, how did they find out? You know, did they do a kind of ultrasound? Like, how did they discover that your intestines were in this terrible shape? And he said, oh, no, none of that. The doctor put her naked ear at one point and then a stethoscope up to my stomach. And she listened very carefully to the sounds that my gut was making. And from there, she was able to diagnose exactly what the problem was. So really, stomach grumbles are, I think, you know, are really incredible, incredible things. You know, they give us some sign to the trained ear, at least, some indication of what is going on in the kind of deep mysteries of our body. And I think, as we've been talking about, you know, I think the stomach grumbles in ways which are also, you know, felt in language, in culture, and in society.
Well, Elsa Richardson, it's been a delight to talk to you about this amazing, fascinating book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dave. I had a lovely chat, and thank you for letting me tell you lots of disgusting stories.
Thanks again to our guest, Elsa Richardson, lecturer on the history of medicine at the University of Strathclyde, Glasgow, and the author of the new book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut. It's published in the U.S. by Pegasus Books and available at most major booksellers, or order it from your local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.